This podcast is a member of WGPRN, WildGamesProductions.com.
This is Tori from the Dead Game Society. Welcome to our podcast, the DGS. We play with dead things.
Welcome to another episode of the Dead Game Society podcast. My name is Chad. I'm your host, along with my faithful co-hosts, Colin and Michael. Hey, guys.
Hey,
that's,
Chad.
That's my cue. Hey, Chad. How are you doing?
Hey, Michael. I'm doing fine. Thank you. So.
Next sentence. I'm doing fine.
I will see it again and again. Speaking of that, the Tony Awards are playing tonight, so if you're listening to this, you're obviously not a fan of Broadway. Okay, so what are you guys, by the way, up to this weekend?
Michael?
Well, I'm taking a sip from my beverage right now. Oh, you were talking about, like, just in general. Well, I have been getting ready for our trip to Origin, not running, just relaxing. And the other thing I've been doing is working on my adventures for Nexus that's coming up next the following weekend, which is kind of fun. So I've been working on my Simpsons adventure, plus punching up my the other adventures I'm working on. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm running four games there, and they're almost sold out. So if you guys want, you know, I have a couple of seats for Catastrophe. So if anyone's listening, our one fan out there, he needs to get to Nexus.
Yeah, well, Nexus starts on...
We know who he is.
When is Nexus, Colin?
Oh, I was just about to say, June 19th is when Nexus starts. It's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We've kind of said a few things about it before, but tons of events. There's like 420 events. And then, Michael, you're running your Simpsons adventure. You got Love Boat,
and...
Catastrophe.
What's the other one? Oh, my Nightmare on Sesame Street.
Oh, yeah, Nightmare on Sesame Street.
Right,
okay.
Which I'm adding a new character. The Count will make an appearance. I wrote him.
Puppets?
I have his puppet and everything.
Full puppets. Nice.
It's going to be fun. I got my Bob costume ready to go. But the only thing is I was going to bring my Kiss costume, you know, the full Jean.
Yeah, the Destroyer armor.
Yeah, but unfortunately because I have a lot of things going on, I couldn't pack it, so I'm going to be the ultimate Kiss fan. I found my old...
You're going as yourself?
Nay. I'm going as like a burnout Kiss fan. I got my not my destroyer, but my.
You're going as your old neighbor.
Shirts and.
Dude, I'm going as the burnout.
Dirty jeans.
Yeah, absolutely. I found my old Kiss jersey. It's like read the novel through it. So threadbare, but. So yeah, I'm gonna rock that out there, and it's gonna be a lot of fun.
Well, you know, many of the ultimate Kiss fans did used to actually coincidentally read novels while waiting for the band to come out. That's a little known fact.
Yeah. I heard. Yeah, they were all into Googling thing, and they would trade books during.
Yeah, War and Peace.
Absolutely.
Little Women.
Okay, I have a problem with that, because I saw the movie Little Women. They were regular size. I'm just saying.
Yeah, there were no midgets in that movie.
No, there were. I thought they were going to be little, but they were like regular size. It's such a ripoff.
Leave it to Michael to complain about Winona Ryder.
Oh, no. Oh, that's right. They remade that movie. I was talking about the old black and white one.
Oh, the old black and white. I didn't remember that one.
She would have been a little woman if she had been in the original one.
She would have been like, not even, I think.
Well, you remember Wizard of Oz. I mean, Dorothy Gale in the original book was like 8. And then suddenly she's like 18.
Suddenly she blossomed.
Well, in Kansas, they do grow up fast.
They blossom quick there, just like...
Absolutely. Yeah, they do.
Absolutely. That's why I don't live in Kansas anymore.
So, now, in the next couple of days, though, you guys are heading over to Origins, right?
Yeah, that is right.
I won't be able to make this year, unfortunately. Sorry, guys.
We're going to head out there. John's coming out with us. Because it's right before Nexus, and we're running a ton of games at Nexus, we're just going to relax at Origins. We're just going to schmooze and hang out and play in some of those really cool events that they have there. They have, like, Eldritch Entertainment. It's got a lot of really cool events and tons of board games and card games, and just going to have fun, relax. And then when we come back, of course, on the 19th of June, you know, Nexus starts. And, of course, we have a ton of games. I'm going to be running Call of Cthulhu, my World War II, you know, with full-on NKVD Russians shooting SS officers, you know, all that kind of stuff, and monsters, and humansies, and, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah, humansies, man.
Humansies.
Absolutely. But
must have humansies.
The question is, you have the Nazis, and you have humansies. Who is the true monster there?
I'm going to leave that for the players to decide.
Or could there be a Nazi humanity?
Yeah, there could be.
There may be.
No spoilers here.
Der Fury. Furry.
Der Fury?
Der Furry Fur.
What really happened, Adolf, huh?
Okay. First off, this is why I don't drink, because I don't want to sound like an idiot. Okay.
Well,
anyway,
might as well drink that.
What's luck there?
So in addition to that, I also have a couple of D&D games I'm running, which is going to kind of tie into what we're talking about tonight. I have a couple basic D&D games, big, huge, epic campaigns that are going to be running, you know, featuring mass battle and dragons and all that good stuff. So we'll talk about that later on. And then, Chad, you have, like, you're running Gangbusters?
Yeah, at Nexus, I'm running Gangbusters. I'm doing an adventure where the players get to bootleg. They get to run the bootleg rum or gin or hooch through Chicago. That should be fun. It's always been pretty fun in the past. It's a game that you don't see as much. So, you know, and I can't wait till the episode when we get to cover Gangbusters.
I know.
That'll be a real fun
one. We'll get there, because we still have to cover all the D&D stuff. So we're going to do what?
A lot more D&D.
Second edition and third. All right,
2017.
Like
I mean, we could be doing D&D forever.
And that's the point. And I'm going to say it. I said it earlier, and it probably got cut, but I am so sick of Dungeons & Dragons. I'm ready to move on. So let's get this over with.
Oh, actually, we're joking. That's a little joke out there.
No, I am not joking. I am not joking. I am so sick.
Don't worry, guys. We are moving on from D&D. We have some other games lined up.
What else are you running, Chad?
Other games, I'm doing Top Secret, which will be featuring my own backdrop rules, Cold War backdrop rules, I call Checkpoint Charlie. Call Cthulhu, I believe, my Titanic adventure again.
Oh, sweet.
I think. I'd have to look at it again, but I think I Oh,
I
I'm
thought
doing
it was the Tunguska affair.
Oh, it is. It might be the Tunguska affair.
That's why I don't drink.
I'll have to. Well, actually, I can look at these.
This is what happens when you start creating a lot of different adventures and running them. You start to forget which ones you're running at that adventure. You have to.
I don't
check
know. I don't have to say it's the alcohol, because I know all the games I'm running, I think.
Yeah, when you only have four games to run at every convention, that it does make it simpler, Michael.
Oh, boo.
No, Michael's
didn't
got it.
Didn't Chad run like 10 games or something one time at GaryCon?
No, yeah, I know. It was absolutely nuts. I'm like,
right. I'm there like 5 in the morning, and he's like sitting there gaming with people.
That's not happening again.
Well, yeah, I know. It was awesome, because, I mean, this guy is just rolling in from, like, a drunken stupor. But it runs games. Like, it was like no.
Well, that made my Boo Hill game all the better, though, the next day. I could sound just like Sam Elliott.
Oh, that's right.
Here's my story. I got bombed one night, and I didn't have an adventure to 4 and in PM, so I am, like, hanging all day and, like, in the shower, like, crying, like, you know, because I want to make sure I was, you know, not hungover for the game. Of course, it turned out fine, but, you know, Chad rolls right out, and it's just like, give me my drink, let's go. Got your dice. Let's go.
All right.
I'm your Huckleberry.
Play a little Boot Hill.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I don't know how you do it. You tell me how you do it, and I still don't get it. A hot shower and
hot shower and lots of crack.
Oh.
Yeah.
We'll leave that one alone. So moving on.
So that's pretty much, you know, what we're up to. And like I did say, you know, earlier, we're going to finish up this episode. We're going to finish up our basic classic D&D, I guess you'd say, which means we'll have covered the white box as well as the basic / classic. And then we're probably going to move over at that point over to Boot Hill, because, you know, it's another game that came out really early on in the in the history of games. I believe 1975 Boot Hill was released, and so you can look forward to us talking about that.
Yeah,
and I think we have some other great interviews also coming up in the future, so we really hope you enjoyed the Ed Greenwood interview. Which I thought was really cool of him to do for us. And again, thanks go out to Alex Kamer, all the guys at Gamehole for setting that one up for us. But, you know, look for other great ones to come. We may have some interviews with the creators of some of the other great games, like maybe even Top Secret. That reminds me, Merle Rasmussen will be at Nexus, won't he?
Yes, he absolutely will. And running games.
Yes, indeed.
Maybe we can, you know, corner him for an interview.
That is a very big possibility. As a matter of fact, I was on the phone with Merle last week. Yeah.
Basically, so where are we here, guys? So last time we left off, right? We were talking about Old Bane Cook, right? Essentially, the basic D&D early 80s. You know, 1980, 1981, 82 versions of Dungeons and Dragons. And now, as we talked about last time, we're going to kind of transition into this, these Mensa rules. We're going to talk all about the rule encyclopedia, and then maybe, you know, some supplements and stuff that came out around that time. Those of you that are interested, we're probably not going to cover the Gazetteers too much in this episode. I'm going to save that for another episode where we're going to deal with those in depth.
Yeah, the Gazetteers really deserve their own episode entirely, and that'll be something really more, I think, in the future, but definitely they deserve their own episode, and I am a huge fan of the Gazetteers. I thought Mistara was awesome, and I had the privilege of sitting and having drinks with Bruce Hurd at GaryCon, at the last GaryCon, and in fact, sitting right next to him was Merle Rasmussen, and boy, that was interesting. But like Colin said, I think that's an episode for the future. So I'm not going to claim to be an expert on the Mensa rules per se, because by the time most of the Mensa rules were coming out for basic, expert, basic. Well, yeah, you had your expanded, your masters, your companion, your immortal set, your Beckme, right, Colin?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
By that point, I was really into my first edition AD&D, so I wasn't really playing that game. But Colin, I know you're really into the Mensa rules. I am fairly familiar with the Mulvey rules. Again, I was probably more at home with Holmes, but enough that I think we can have nice comparisons going on if we want to refer back to Mulvey.
I think what happened was, you know, back when I was, you know, a teenager, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old, I lived in Germany. I lived in Frankfurt. And if I'm not mistaken, the Beckme rules were one of the first comprehensive rule sets from D&D to really make a splash overseas. Now, I might be wrong on that, but I remember my German buddies, they all had the red box and mm-hmm. all the Beckme stuff. Now, they had AD&D too, but what they would do is they would just like interchangeably go from one to the other. It, like, they didn't, you know, or at least I didn't, kind of realize that there were fundamental differences in the rules. You know,
so they created hybrids out of it then.
Oh, absolutely. And if you'll notice, it's jumping ahead a little bit, but you'll notice that, like, for instance, like in the rule encyclopedia, right, there are, in the appendices, there are basically recommendations and rules for converting basic, you know, Beckme D&D to AD&D. You know, so it's easy to go back and forth. So I think maybe that's why I got super into it, because it's what everybody was playing back when I was a kid.
Well, why do you think they liked it so much? I mean, was there anything in particular you think that drew them? Were there other games going on at that time over there?
Yeah, well, I guess maybe, you know, I haven't thought too much about it, but I know that, you know, you think about Europe, you think about, you know, Essen, and it's these huge, like, gaming conventions and stuff they have over there. I mean, like, the Central Europeans, the Germans, to some extent the French, certainly the Swiss, and they're, like, super into gaming. You know, they love gaming. They love board gaming.
Oh, yeah, I see that
board gaming. And they like RPG gaming too. And it, I don't know, maybe it's just a cultural thing. I don't know, but it was really big when I was there. I mean, I used to tell people, I used to joke around and tell them about, we used to go to this little place in a little town north of Frankfurt, and it's called Joe's Rauschenkammer. It means like Joe's smoking room, and it was a 14th century building, and it had this like bar that was in the basement. But really what it was a converted wine cellar from, you know, the 14th century or whatever. And so it had all these like little cubby holes and areas where you could actually like sit and game all night and drink.
Oh, nice.
And like this huge cloud of smoke. And like all the kids, you know, because there's no drinking age there, all the high school kids would come like pouring into this place on like Saturday night. And we'd bring our D&D stuff and we would just drink and game and smoke until like 4 in the morning.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I mean, it was, and you're like in a 14th century room. So.
Yeah, that would be really cool. That really would be kind of cool.
Well, then, Colin, you would smuggle
children out,
right? from the United States.
Sorry.
No, from the United States. Colin had told me the story that not only would he smuggle drugs, but he'd also smuggle like D&D products. Like, and one time he got busted, it was just like Midnight Express, where he like lifts up. No, he'd like lift up, and he had like, you know, the mental boxes taped to his,
wow,
his body.
Wow, that brings
like
a whole new definition to the word getting a mule for D&D, you know?
Don't even know what that means.
No, the Germans used to give me, like, you know, 500 Deutschmarks to basically go to the United States when I was visiting my family or whatever and buy anything D&D related I could find. So I bought everything. And some of it was, like, valuable. You know, it's like, I wish I had some
you
of this.
Wish you had that.
Like, I was in London at one point, and I got Up the Garden Path. Remember that? It's like a $1,200 module. There's only, like, a handful ever produced.
Oh, wow.
And I went to, like, this little shop in London, and then they were like, you know, they had D&D stuff there, and they had like 5 copies of it, and I bought all 5 and like handed it out to my German friends.
Oh, man.
I wish I had those back.
Yeah. Did you ever happen to pick up an orange copy of Palace of the Salt Princess?
I did not, although I did talk to somebody at GaryCon. I can't remember his name, but he does have it. As a matter of fact, wow. I think he has 2.
Oh, wow.
He's some heavy hitter, big guy. We'll get him on the show. We'll interview him. He's a super cool guy. I forget what his name is, but he actually has.
No, Alex knows him, though.
Oh, right.
We should talk to
that's another guy
Alex.
That has a lot of pretty rare stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're going to see him at Game Hole, and he'll, like, let us go into, you know, the secret room for the gaming stuff, and we can totally pants whenever you want up there, man. We'll just totally rip him off.
Oh,
so.
I thought you just meant we could pants him. I was just like, what?
I didn't know where that was going.
No, like, when you go, so you guys, like, oh, God, you guys are such, no, like, when you pants something, you, like, shove it down your pants.
Oh, I just thought it meant you
Teddy
went,
Larson,
I just pulled their pants down.
I don't know where you guys are going with that, but no.
Surprise, Alex!
Oh, my God. He actually might not mind that too much.
Oh,
But anyway, you know.
I get what you're saying, though.
Aside from AD&D, which, you know, I played a lot, you know, when I was a kid, too, you know, before I actually went to Europe, you know, but, you know, that was kind of like that Beckme set was huge. I guess, you know, I'll realize, like, the differences, really, and until, like, years later between the sets.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I guess, you know, some people say, like, I was kind of doing a little research on online and stuff, and some people say, maybe you guys can chime in, that Moldvay aims his writing, right, at a younger audience, right, if you're looking at the Moldvay, you know, box sets and stuff, while Menser, where you get to the red box, blue box, writes for an adult audience. I mean, do you guys find that to be the case?
From what I've read, I could see that argument might be made. If you've read the Rule Cyclopedia, which is really a compendium of the Menser editions, it does come across probably in a more complicated, I guess you would say, format. It's a format that would probably be better with adults. Whereas the Moldvay edition did seem, you know, I remember playing that when I was a kid, so I didn't have any problems reading it. The art was a little bit more fantastical, almost, I mean, it was Errol Otis art, which is hard to explain. It's really awesome, but But from a kid's standpoint, you know, it's not as intimidating, perhaps, the Moldvay edition.
Right. Which artwork do you prefer, Michael? The Errol Otis or the...
The Otis stuff. I love that style of artwork. In fact, we need him, or we'll pay him, of course, to do a DGS Dead Games cover. I have a layout in mind, but I really like that style. It's so unique and so much fun. Now, of course, I also appreciate the Easley art and also Elmore's artwork as well. It's more polished and clean and everything like that. So when I think of D&D, I think of really those three artists. I mean, I appreciate the newer artwork, of course, like the Reynolds artwork. I love that stuff. But certainly the Otis stuff is amazing. And I still love looking at it because it's like one of those things, like when I look at one of his pieces of work, there's just so much going on there and the colors are so vibrant. It really gives that sense across.
It almost had kind of a 70s kind of feel to it or something.
And
almost
surreal and surreal.
Surreal quality. I loved reading, I remember looking at a lot of his artwork back when I was playing and running the Slaver modules. There is quite a bit of his artwork in there, especially with, I still to this day can't think of the Myconids mushroom people. I imagine them, I imagine them as drawn by Errol Otis.
Yeah, in the dungeons of the Slave Lords, right?
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what I picture. That one, that kind of wide-paned picture of like the heroes like fighting all these mushroom guys.
Exactly. It's like something out of a deranged Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what it was intended to be.
On their face. It's amazing. It's hard to describe Errol Otis's work. And, of course, anybody who came into gaming in the mid to late 80s, now they're probably going to feel much more at home with the art found in the Mincer rules, because at that point, we have more Larry Elmore. And when I think of Larry Elmore, I immediately think of Dragonlance.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
All of that awesome. I mean, just fantastic fantasy art. But that came to be iconic for D&D, I think, in the mid to late 80s, whereas Errol Otis was much more iconic for it in the early 80s.
Yeah, I really think that Errol Otis, and I mean, again, he may disagree with us, but it was almost like D&D meets Lewis Carroll.
Yeah,
exactly. It was bizarre and otherworldly. It was weird.
Whimsical, and I mean, it's like this kind of softness to it, and I don't know, I just really, really dig it. It's like a good trip,
Yeah, it's like when you watch Disney, Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, It's like the art in that almost.
Yeah.
No, I don't know what
I
don't see the reference. Now, you said it's a mouse of some sort?
No, not the mouse.
But anyway, so what the Mentor box, when that came out, and I think I was about 14, I think you guys are probably about the same age. It didn't come with a module, right?
The
Moldvay came with what module came with, Michael?
Something.
Yeah,
it came with one that had a cover. I remember it.
Keep on the board.
And it had pages too.
No, not that one. It was
the Moldvay Red Box.
It had a module in it.
Yes, it did.
But Mentor's basic box.
It's Keep on the Borderland.
I don't know. Mentor's
box.
Not that one.
The Mentor blue box did come with Isle of Dread.
Yes, it did.
We'll have to spend an entire episode on that one.
For the expert rules.
Yeah. But then, of course, we get into the rules differences between Moldvay and Mentor. And then, of course, the rule cyclopedia, right? So Moldvay...
Oh, yeah. What were some of the key rules differences then?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Moldvay stops at level 3, right? And Cook's expert set, right, continue that to level 14, right? Now, Mentor set, right, the Beckme stuff, I mean, that goes all the way up to 36.
Right, right? But now,
if you're a human, you can go all the way to 36 levels. That's crazy, right?
Right,
but
keeping in mind that's if you're playing with all of his box sets. Because correct. I believe even Mincer's first set ends at third level, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. It's at a third or fourth, but yeah, it ends at a relatively low level.
Right. Now, of course, if you're using the real encyclopedia, that's all moot anyway, because that is all his sets. All
right, right. Solos. It's aggregated all together. Right. And yeah, that's right. So it ends at level three in the red set.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, tell us a little bit give us a brief synopsis, because I know you do a lot. You run this quite a bit more than anybody else amongst us. Explain what are the different sets that make up BECMI.
Right. Obviously, you have the basic red set, right? And that really is supposed to serve as an introductory system, introduction to D&D. It's written in such a way that's very, it assumes that the person who's reading it has no knowledge of RPG gaming at all. And nowadays, you kind of laugh about that. Like, we open up a new RPG system, like a Shadowrun or something, and the first chapter is like, well, what is an RPG game? Well, you know, now we laugh about it. Everybody knows what an RPG game is.
So you want to play an RPG.
Right, but back then, and we're talking about like 1983, okay, 1984, no, I mean, people really didn't know what an RPG game was, you know? That acronym barely even existed. Back then, we had Dungeons and Dragons, and then, I mean, we had all these other games on the periphery that had very small audiences. I mean, some of which were totally awesome games, which we'll talk about. But, I mean, D&D was like the 800-pound girl in the room. And so it was written in such a way as to kind of like lead you into it. And it gives you that great introductory adventure where you kind of, without even like basically writing up a character or anything, you kind of like, you're kind of pulled in. To this adventure, right? With, was it Alina the Cleric and Bargle and all that stuff?
And it had Morgan Ironwolf.
That's right.
Well, I have a question. You
and Meslo.
Right. Hold on a minute. You mentioned the 800-pound gorilla. Now, what was the AC on that?
And what
whatever you want it to be. -10,
was it
I guess.
Carnivorous ape?
That seems dangerous to put in a room and try to adventure around it.
Well, you know, when we get to Isle of Jed, we'll talk more about carnivorous apes.
Yeah. Are they 800 pounds?
They might be.
I'm sure. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. Now, is this an NPC? Does it talk?
you can make it talk, I guess.
Well, you were the one that brought it up. I just want to know a little, because I don't want the audience to be confused. When you throw...
I think they're confused.
Sure. Out like this, it's like all of a sudden, it's just like, I don't understand what we're...
It's the big elephant in the room.
Oh, shit. Now there's an elephant?
Yes. And I just watched The Protector today, and they actually, you know, if you're big fans of Ong Bak, by the way, sorry, got to diverge here, but... It's the only movie you're going to get to see a guy throw an elephant, a baby elephant. That is so awesome. So, anyway, back on track.
Like, I don't want to see elephants.
What happens, Michael?
Yeah, this is what happens when you when you invite Michael.
You anyway, end up talking about baby elephants getting thrown.
That's right.
That's horrible. I mean, it's just like the PETA should be watching out for the baby elephants.
It's not. So, anyway, Colin.
No. Anyway. So the E in Abecmi, of course, is the expert set. It's the blue set. And you know what's fun about this set is not only do you obviously can go from character levels 4 to 14, right? Mm-hmm. You also get some interesting maps, right? In
so
the middle
expert
of the
did allow you to go up to 14th level then. It wasn't.
No, it did, yeah. And then you have, for instance, right in the middle of the player's guide, you have map number 1, the Grand Duchy of Kermakos.
Oh, the Grand Duchy of Kermakos?
Suddenly.
Grand Duchy of what?
Kermakos.
Oh, Kermakos. I always called it Kermakos, yeah.
Right, right.
Okay.
So, anyway, but in the middle of the expert set, you actually get a map of that, where really before then, it was the known world, right? Remember, not Greyhawk, we're talking about basic D&D here. So no Greyhawk involved, this is the known world. So that was cool. So suddenly the game starts taking on a more epic scope, right? It starts putting you into a gaming world, a campaign world. You can go all the way up to 14th level, which is pretty high. You know, I mean, you can cast some serious spells at that all the way up to 7th, 8th level, and it greatly expands the adventure. And then, of course, the C is the companion rules. And what kind of things do the companion rules introduce, Chad? I mean,
well, the companion rules start getting you up to the point now where you're going to start having your own fiefs, your own castles, you're going to be more, you're fairly high level. I mean, you're over 15th level at this point. I believe the companion set is to start introducing your character to the realities of power.
Absolutely. Yeah, which really makes it very, very cool because, and I've said this before, but I think that the reason I love these sets so much is that there's a logical, rational progression to the game, right? You start off as kind of a dungeon wandering adventure, searching for treasure or whatever, trying to keep yourself fed and armored, right? Then it moves in the expert set where you have wilderness adventures. You know, you have more like the scope starts to kind of expand. You have engagements in the mountains and the oceans and islands and all this kind of stuff. And then you get into the companion roles, and then suddenly, wow, you know, you can buy yourself a castle, right? You can start controlling a fiefdom. You can start controlling a kingdom, right? And then there's rules, obviously, in the companion set for like taxation, for when people might revolt. You know, you could get like an unhappy populace. They could revolt, barons or dukes or whatever could revolt against you. And then you could have a big problem on your hands. So the game world expands massively. And then, of course, it gets into the master set, right? Which is the black, the M, back me, where really then it starts taking on a worldly scope, right?
Right. Now it's no longer local politics. It's more like global politics.
Oh, absolutely. And then suddenly gods start getting involved, right? Start taking notice of you.
Well, don't get me started on that.
Yeah.
Oh,
I hate when that happens. All the time, but,
but, you know, but it's an interesting point you bring up. You know, another game that I think has taken some heavy cues, at least in setting up there for the, I guess, the... what's the word for it? The ascension factor would be recently from the Mincer set would be Adventure Conquer King. It seems like
right. This
is the first, you know, that's the first game we really start to see that again. And, you know, that's many years afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, at Master's set, though, how does Mincer go about explaining the difference in being a ruler, say, at the companion level to being a ruler at the master's level?
I think here we have to go to the modules to try to, like, get an idea. And of course, you know, we'll talk more about the modules in subsequent episodes. But, you know, when you get into these, like, for instance, the companion module is a CM1, you know, Test of the Warlords. Mm-hmm. That kind of has you... you know, managing your domain, you know, going out to fight the frost giants, you know, going out to deal with these rebels, dealing with these kind of domain kingdom scale problems, right? When you get to the master modules, like M1, M2, M3, suddenly the gods are starting to take notice. There's intrigues, war, you know, political, diplomatic strife and strategery, you know, between actual empires, right? Like Thyatis and Alphatia, right? And, and then it's like you're involved now with this. So it's not just you and your little petty kingdom in the middle of nowhere, right? So now you're like involved in things in a global scale. And then, of course, it takes you into other dimensions. So it may take you into otherworldly adventures, right? And then, of course, the ultimate goal is immortality, and that could lead you into the immortal set, right? Which is the final set in that series. Now, of course, that changes when Aaron Alston, you know, with the Rule Cyclopedia and everything, also wrote a set called The Wrath of the Immortals, which kind of revised those rules. So Mincer came out with the Immortal set, which we'll talk about in another episode because that's a topic in of itself that's kind of beyond what we're talking about here. But Aaron Alston and others also came up with this kind of new, you know, imagining of how the immortal adventures would take place. So that's when you get beyond 36 level and you cross into divinity, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think in the future what we could do is maybe we could have a show where we cover the different ways that immortality has been handled by the different game producers, such as Frank Mincer. I know that the Gazetteers also had a system for immortality, which was actually really cool. That dealt, some people are familiar with the Radiance, and I know that they had different paths that you could take to immortality. I don't know if Mincer's, because I haven't really played the immortal rules for Mincer's set. Do you know then, Colin, did they use like paths to immortality like they did in the Gazetteers?
Yeah, they did to some extent. Yeah. And then of course, you know, once you obtain this level, then there's actually levels within immortality.
And do they have to like complete a, does the immortal set up the players to become immortal, or are they already assumed to be immortal?
As far as I know, they're already assumed to be immortal at the lowest kind of level, right?
Right. So then probably the Masters set is the ultimate goal of when you're playing the Masters is ultimately to finish it out by becoming a god.
Yeah, retirement or immortality, right? Backing up a little bit.
Sounds delish.
Yeah. So some other differences between, let's see, like for instance, Moldvay, right? And if we're backing up to there, Moldvay magic users get one spell at first level and have to find more in play, right? Mentors get one spell plus read magic at first level, and then a new one at every level after that. Let's see what else we have. It's a mentor slows down the advancement of saving throws, thieves' abilities, and spell acquisitions for clerics and magic users. And one thing I did notice, not too many people talk about, is that when you move from mentor, right, not talking about Moldvay anymore, but when you move from mentor actually to the rule cyclopedia, mm-hmm. right, the hear noise ability of the thieves mm-hmm. goes from a D6 roll, remember that?
Right.
Right, to a percentile roll. Right. So if you crack open the rule cyclopedia, look at that, it's different, right? You don't hear noise in a Moldvay or even the early mentor editions is, you know, on a 1 and a 2, you hear the noise on a D6, right? But on the rule cyclopedia, where you might get 20% chance or 25% chance, that kind of thing. Castle building rules are more detailed in Moldvay, but mentor details a base town and talks about running town adventures. Then, let's see, what else we have between Moldvay? Moldvay states that clerics get their spells from gods. Mentor gets kind of...
Yeah, it's really more of a belief system, right?
Right, right. It's Mentor says that this is... he's kind of ambiguous about this and says that about this aspect of the game. And he only says that clerics get their spells from their beliefs. I don't know if that's a big thing, but it's...
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where you kind of read between the lines, I guess. I mean, it depends. Like, the way I run clerics, it could actually become a big thing because I run the whole system where clerics get their spells taught to them while they're dreaming by servants or avatars of their deity. If now, when you start talking about their power comes from their belief, it's almost more like their own faith powers them with this ability to do cast these miracles, I guess you would say, as opposed to being simply a channel through which the deity works.
Sure.
That could be read into it. You could definitely see that coming up as a, you know, one of those debates that players sometimes have with the DM.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, how would you do it, Michael? Would the cleric get his or her powers and spells and abilities from their conviction, their beliefs in their god? Or is it just something that's like, I don't know,
well, I think,
just their beliefs?
Yeah, I think, you know, from the beliefs, you know, it really depends on how you want to run it, because a cleric can lose favor, of course, with their deities. And depending on how you do it, is if he's getting directly from, say, the deity, and he displeases his deity, he could, you know, I guess revoke some of blessings or whatever. But if you have the other way, if the cleric does some bad deeds or whatever, he may lose. He starts maybe losing his faith, and then you can also use that as an adventuring tool so that he has to kind of, do better so that he feels better, and then therefore his spells are more powerful and things like that. You can have fun with it.
Well, what if you went about it this way? Now, here's where I could see it becoming a stumbling block. In general, I would say a paladin's innate abilities come from their just general conviction. Right, their sense of their belief, whereas the cleric spells come from being taught. You know, each night the deity grants certain spells to them. But if you were to run clerics from the idea that their spells are really more of a byproduct of simply their conviction, their belief, say they see enough bad stuff happen to the good, then would the DM be okay to start? At what point does, if the cleric, for whatever reason, sees enough bad stuff happening that he starts to doubt, the goodness of his deity, a temple to his deity collapses and kills all the worshippers, right? Does that mean his powers stop working? He hasn't done anything bad, per se, to lose his clerichood. But he's now doubting his deity. If you ran it from a pure conviction point of view, I think he would start to lose his spells. If you were running it from him getting some one-on-ones with at least the servitors of his deity each night, then probably not, because now at least he can ask his questions, although I guess if he questions his deity too often, then he could lose his powers that way too. It sounds subtle on the outside, but it could actually become troublesome in the game. I think it's something that every DM will need to actually decide on their own how they're going to run that one.
Oh yeah, I it's definitely DM's discretion on that, and I think you should kind of develop that how you see fit. I think maybe, partly what Mentor was talking about when he said, they get their powers from their beliefs. And there may have been a certain political element with that, because remember, this is 1983, 1984.
That too.
Yeah, the whole, D&D scare with,
What year did
children worshiping Baphomet,
Yeah, that was 83 that he came out with that?
Yeah, I think the red set is 83, yeah.
Well, then, yeah, I guess that's a good point. As Ed Greenwood was saying in his interview, he wanted to get into a lot more detail concerning Lucifer, and he wanted to actually detail out, if you read the Monster Manual, in first edition, that they talk about the demons and devils having symbols, right? And he wanted to get into those, and at the same time, Gary and Frank were like, no!
Yeah,
that's all we need.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, it's kind of funny that they just didn't have one archdevil, they had several,
Oh man, I thought that was kind of funny. But at the same time, he had mentioned that it was Gary and Frank who had kind of said, whoa, we got to back off a little bit on that right now. That's probably not the right social environment out there. And that would go a long ways to explaining perhaps why Frank had gone simply saying beliefs as opposed to playing up the gods.
Yeah, they played it down. I mean, they deliberately played it down, and I mean, I can understand that,
Yeah.
Considering what was going on at that time. Anyway, so back to the sets, then you get to these differences, of course, between the Beckme sets, right, and the Rule Cyclopedia. And the Rule Cyclopedia was, compiled by Aaron Alston. It was basically meant to be a combination of the Beckme sets, not including the Immortal, right? Because the Immortal was redone, right? It was reimagined. We'll talk about that in another episode, but it was supposed to be the basic, the X Companion and Master Rules, right? Kind of in one volume with monsters and weapons, mm-hmm. and pretty much everything you need to play. What one person online says, one major break from the traditional setup is that Alston broke away from the traditional class archetypes and added skills, right, in the Rule Cyclopedia. But in reality, the skill system actually came out in one of the gazetteers, right? The first gazetteer, which is the Grand Duchy of Kamaric
Yep, Grand Duchy of Kuramikos.
It's in there, page 9. You can take a look at there. Basically, the idea was is that, you know, low-level characters get a certain number of skills. I think it's 4 at first level slots, right, that they can use, that they can develop, maybe horseback riding or brewing or diplomacy or who knows what, right? And then what these skills are connected to your attributes, right? Dexterity, intelligence, wisdom. You simply do a skill roll, right, which is rolling underneath your attribute, which we've been doing for, you know, 40 years or whatever. But if you take extra slots or you take extra ranks in these skills, it gives you a bonus. So let's say you really want to be a great horseman, right? Let's say you're a paladin, and it makes sense for a paladin to be able to ride its war horse or her war horse really well. So you basically take, let's say, 3 ranks or whatever in horsemanship. This will give you a +2 on your check. So if you have a dex of 14, you roll, you only need to get under a 12 to make that horse, you know, horsemanship check. Mm-hmm. So that was introduced in the Gazetteer. That was carried over into the Rule Encyclopedia, where they have a more extensive list of skills and options as far as developing those. And of course, then that kind of carried over to AD&D 2nd edition, certainly carried over to 3rd edition.
It's a bit too much.
Right, where it's really, you know, heavy, you know, in terms of skills.
What, you want to climb a wall? I'm sorry, you don't have that skill.
Right.
Your limbs don't operate in that fashion. Your opposable thumbs have ceased to be opposable.
Right.
But now, didn't they also introduce, Colin, a weapons mastery?
They did, yeah. In the Master Set, right, in the Menster Edition, they introduced Weapon Mastery. And not only would a weapon give you, let's say, a bonus to attack or a bonus on the number of attacks that you could do per round, depending on your level, you could also do things like, panic your enemies, right, through, you know, this display of spectacular skill with your weapon, right? You can introduce this kind of psychological effect.
Yeah, we call that weapon noodling, like how
weapon noodling.
Absolutely.
Like how hair bands used to do like that, all that shitty stuff.
Kind of like, in Indiana Jones, where you can now whip the sword all around before somebody shoots you with a gun.
Is that a movie?
It was actually a biopic about a guy who I thought it was amazing. I don't know how they got the cameraman in all those situations with him. Especially when the boulder was, that guy must have been moving with that camera. It was wonderful. Really, you should check it out.
I should. Okay, what's it called?
It's on the History Channel. It's called Indiana Jones, A Man and His Life.
Indiana.
Yes.
Okay, I'll check that out.
Hey, Chad?
Really good. Uh-huh.
Can we pause just for a second here?
Sure.
Yeah, you can edit this out, right? I'll be right back.
Yeah,
I need the bathroom. Sorry, I'll be right back.
Yep, go right ahead.
That's why you need a bucket with a toilet seat.
I'm really going to edit it out.
Well, seriously, it's like if you have to go to the bathroom to the podcast, I have a bucket with a toilet seat.
That's right.
Like next
we
year,
hear it.
I can just go. No, I put them. Dude, I'm not a pig. I put the mute on the mic.
On
mute.
That's the type of guy you are, Michael.
You know, this is because I bring class to this podcast.
You bring all sorts of things.
I bring hepatitis. I bring herpes. Wait, no, that's not true. Yeah, I edit that out. But no, I try to bring.
Sure,
I try to bring class to this thing. You know, that's why I always wear a suit.
Trying is the first step towards succeeding. So you keep trying, buddy.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
You're welcome. That was my inspirational moment.
Oh, yeah, I actually feel all warm and fuzzy inside, but that could be the hepatitis.
They have medication for that.
Well, I just
maybe you're turning into a humanzee.
Oh, if I could, that'd be so awesome.
You would be able to climb walls without a skill check.
I know. Now, that's right. How about with the tail, though? Because I want to be like humanzee, but
You would have to be a mankey.
Okay. Oh, I could do that, too.
Well, yeah, you'd have to be a humankey.
A humankey.
Yes.
All right.
A humangee is in the ape family.
Okay. No, I believe it. I really do.
Yeah, should, because there's a tail.
Yes.
On a mankey. And a humangee.
Okay. In the Planet of the Apes.
Human Z.
Hold on.
Would not have a tail.
No, I'm done. I don't care about that anymore.
They're coming out with a new Planet of the Apes movie.
I am moving on from there. No, but okay, in the original Planet of the Apes, they had Dr. Zaius. He's a chimp, orangutan,
Dr.
gorilla.
Dr. Zaius.
Help me, Dr. Zaius. I love that episode.
I love that.
Have you ever heard of Planet of the Apes? The planet or the movie? The Broadway play.
Look, Hobie, it's just like when you tried to teach those monkeys how to reenact the Civil War.
When Homer goes, see, I love it. It's like, ooh, I love legitimate theater. Dude, I'm running that Simpsons game. It's Dial D for Zombie. It's going to be a blast.
Hey, Dad, you killed Zombie Flanders. Flanders was a zombie. Nuclear. It's pronounced nuclear. That's my favorite.
I call the big one Bitey. For the monorail. But anyway, yeah, they get to play.
Monorail!
Monorail! Mono. Go! What's that called again?
I'm going to name my next dog Stampy, I think.
Oh. But anyway, in my Simpsons game, you get to play Homer or Comic Book Guy, Apu, Willie, and Krusty the Clown.
I want to play Comic Book Guy just so I can sit there and go, worst event ever.
It's like, excuse me, are you the creator of High and Lowest? Because you're making me laugh.
Okay, I'm back.
I love that line.
Okay.
Well, you got some filler. At least we got some filler
good,
in here.
I got some good filler.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
You got to add some of that in there. I think
it's
hilarious.
Definitely.
The weapon mastery. Let's check it. Page 15.
Okay.
I can't remember what that term was called for, like, panicking the enemy here.
Weapon noodling.
Weapon noodling.
Look at my big sword. Yeah, this is so good, yeah?
Yeah.
Come on, Homer. I will keep screaming slogans at you. Feel the burn.
Oh, my God. We should do a Simpsons. You know, we should have a whole episode on my Simpson adventure.
You know, Gary Gygax was on Simpsons once.
That's right, he was.
Wait, are you sure?
I rolled a dice. They asked Gary a question, and he rolled a dice and then looked up and said yes.
Well, was that? I thought that was Futurama, though.
Oh, that was Futurama.
Oh, okay.
You guys fail your nerd test.
I know.
But they did have Tom Baker. Damn it.
That's okay. Right, yeah.
Although he didn't actually talk.
Anyway.
So, weapon noodling.
Weapon noodling.
I mean, that's the newest craze with the murder hobos.
That's right. So, 3, 2, 1.
Okay, Colin, so tell us a little bit more about weapon noodling.
Weapon noodling.
He said noodle.
Well, not too many people used the weapon mastery to a great degree. Some people liked it, some people didn't. I've used it kind of off and on. It can lead to a situation where characters become a little bit overpowered, but it can be fun. I mean, it depends on really how crazy you want to get with mm-hmm. what you're throwing at the characters. But also in the Master set, they introduce siege weaponry. If you look on page 25, Mentor brings in the
Master's rules.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. You have the hoist, and you have the belfry, which is basically a siege tower, and you have the scorpion, and ballista, mm-hmm. and all this other stuff. And, of course, they have the damage that they can do against fortifications, against other
people.
Right? Again,
probably talk about sappers and...
Oh, absolutely. Your range and you know, your encumbrance and everything, and how difficult they are to build, how much they cost. And that, of course, gets into the whole idea of mass battle, right? Which is kind of is introduced in the companion set, carried over into the master set, where now, because you're dealing with conflicts on a domain or a kingdom level, right, you have to have some sort of system for adjudicating mass battle, right, and that introduces the battle system.
Now, this was different, though, than the battle, quote-unquote battle system that came out for Advanced, right?
That's right. It's called, actually, the War Machine. That's the kind of technical word for it.
Right, War Machine.
Right, and okay. I think, if I remember correctly, I might be wrong on this is just off the top of my head, but I thought that Frank Mentzer may have originally introduced this idea in Dragon Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to recall reading Dragon Magazine at one point, and there's an article in there about mass battle in basic D&D. But obviously, you know, it appears in the companion rules, and then there's, you know, it carries over into the master, and then of course the rule encyclopedia picks it up, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, grab your rule encyclopedia, open up to page 117, you know, you'll see what this whole war machine is about. And if anybody thinks that basic D&D is so-called quote-unquote wuss D&D, and it's not particularly crunchy, you just need to open up the rule encyclopedia to page 117 and spend a few hours on that little section right there.
Right there, though. See, that was one of the reasons why earlier I was saying that Moldvay probably appealed more to, say, the kids, although, you know, I liked his stuff. You know, whereas Mentzer was considered more of the adult RPG for that. You know, for classic D&D, because it was so much crunchier.
Oh yeah, the crunchiness is optional, right? Which is the beauty of it. It's you know, you can keep, you know, adventuring in dungeons until, you know, the cows come home, until you're happy with it, right? You can go down to the, you know, the
tell your DM can't come up with anything at least.
Yeah, exactly. But if you want to have huge, massive battles involving tens of thousands of men and elves and dragons and everything else, it's you're going to have some way of adjudicating that, right? It's some way of figuring out how that whole thing is going to work, and that's going to get a lot more complex.
Right.
So that's where, of course, the war machine comes in. And I mean, I'll just give a rough kind of, you know, breakdown of kind of how it works, because it is very detailed. Basically, there are certain steps that are involved where I recommend you kind of send the PCs out or you engage the PCs in such a way that they have to build a force. They go out, I don't know, maybe they have to talk to some elves, some dwarves, a whole bunch of humans. They all have to rally up together, and you have this kind of, you know, massive battle against some overwhelming enemy, right? So the first step of it is we call the basic force rating, the BFR, which basically takes into account your leader. The percentage of troops that are name level, remember that? Basic D&D, right? The experience level, the average level of the force. So let's say the average level of the officer is level 6. That'll give you a certain bonus, give you certain points toward your BFR, your basic force rating. Then you have a training factor, how well they're trained, which is pretty amazing to me. It's this detailed. But then you have the equipment factor. Right? Mm-hmm. Do you have poor quality weapons? Do you have good quality weapons? Do you have excellent quality weapons? That too gives you a bonus. Then you come up with some sort of a number, an integer. So let's say you come up with like a number of 90. Then you find your troop class, depending how well trained and how well equipped everything your troops are. And then you calculate this thing called a battle rating, where you divide your basic force rating by 10, and then you calculate some additional bonuses. So let's say 20% of your troops can use missiles. That'd be short bows and javelins, I don't know, slings, whatever. Mm-hmm. That could give you a bonus.
Rocks,
anything, right?
Really? And then, that's always been popular in the Middle East.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, hey, you gotta love the classics.
Yeah, then you might get a bonus for how many troops can use magic items, or are using magic items, right? And you add that together to come up with a total. And then you look at your enemy, you see what their battle rating is going to be, and then you determine your battle results.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And look at your troop ratios, who has the upper hand. You look at your morale, and morale is one of those things, again, it was lost in later editions, right? But morale is like something I love. Okay, I think morale
is great. Morale is one many a battle.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And it's something that's this kind of random nebulous thing. Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, the creatures could lose their morale, you know, NPCs could lose their morale, henchmen, who knows?
What about this? Say you have a one side in a battle, number-wise, crunch all the numbers, one side has a definite advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Is there room for strategy to affect that balance?
There absolutely is, because you have, these are optional rules, they're added on to the already optional rules of the world.
Options. All right.
Options within options.
Listen, yeah, every time absolutely. You say war machine, there's a kiss that always pops
right.
my
Yeah, well, I think we need to play that song.
I love it, man. We should.
Full effect.
We should.
Sorry for the interrupt, but every time I hear it, it's just like, it's a cool song.
When you quote Kiss, it's never an interruption.
Oh, thank you. You know, you guys are so awesome. You know, I think I'll keep you around for a while. Okay.
So, thanks, friendly Fred.
So tactics, right? So depending what the enemy is doing, depending what you're doing, let's say you're enveloping, let's say you're charging, let's say, there's a number of different things you can do, and these are...
Chaining their boats together and setting fire to them.
Who knows, right? I mean, that, again, DM's discretion, right? Okay. Depending what you're doing, right, it can obviously impact the outcome of the battle to find out what happens. If you try to do one thing and your opponent does another, you could get a penalty, or if you try to do something, you might get a bonus. And then, finally, you roll, right, to find these results, and you add all these things together, and you get some sort of result. The result's going to tell you the number of casualties that you suffer, or that your enemy suffers, and whether or not the enemy leaves the field. Or, if they don't completely flee, how far they're driven back. So this is super granular.
So is it a fighting retreat or a rout?
Absolutely. It's a rout, fighting retreat. It could be a number of things. So what we're seeing here essentially is the introduction of tactical wargaming back into D&D in the form of the War Machine.
War Machine!
Absolutely. So which makes
so that brings us back to the big ping pong sized table with all the graybeards and their rulers.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean,
Not then.
They go crazy with that.
Yeah. Then they didn't have the long beards. They were young men and strapping young men.
Strapping young men
with their rulers out and
their rulers.
Yeah, so you don't see too many people playing it, but I mean, if you see me at a convention, if I'm playing basic D&D, or if it's certainly a high level adventure, it's probably going to involve this to some degree.
Well, you ran a game that Michael were.
Oh
you
yeah,
in
I
it?
Was
a.
I was. It was fun.
Yeah, we were in it at GaryCon 3, I want to say, or GaryCon 2
it was
actually.
Two, I believe it was 2.
Yeah, it was GaryCon 2. You ran that one adventure, Colin, and we actually did use these rules, and it was actually it was quite fun, I believe. And, you know, I mentioned this on Roll for Initiative. In fact, I mentioned that game that you ran because we did an episode where we talked about different styles of how to run mass combat. And I mentioned the fact that I liked the system as you ran it from the Mincer rules because... It was neat because our characters actually got to be like part of the planning session,
right.
And we were each running, you know, commanding our own various areas of that army. And it was really fun. I liked it.
It was
so fun.
Yeah, I could see the way Colin ran it. I could totally see myself doing it, you know, like almost like a regular dungeon delve, you know, adventure, and then we go into this like this huge epic battle at the end. It was great. I could see myself doing it for like the whole like 3 or 4 hours.
But I could definitely see if you're playing a 6-hour event. I could definitely see 3 hours. Doing just running, finishing out the big massive combat,
right?
And then the first 3 hours would be, you know, leading up to it,
right? Yeah, and of course, I'm going to be playing actually that adventure again, or running that adventure again in Access. So,
oh, cool,
yeah, not too much of a spoiler, but you know, involves like Thyatis and Karamikos, and you know.
Yeah, and that's one of those times. Usually, I think we always try to run our games around 3 to 4 hours. But if you're gonna run a massive battle, I almost think you have to give yourself about 6 hours because, assuming you want to get regular role play in, you're talking a couple hours of regular role play, probably about 3 hours. You're going to really need to give yourself at least 2 hours for the
right.
big battle.
Oh, yeah. And I think, I think you did that way, Colin.
Yeah. Now it should be said, too, that in the companion rules, I believe it's in the companion rules, Frank Mentor says that if you really want to quickly adjudicate large-scale encounters, he gives you a little abbreviated version of the War Machine to be able to quickly adjudicate. But if you really, really want to get crazy with it, you can. Which yeah, some people do. It's great. I mean, it's a blast.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was going to say, too, the other thing, there's the Sea Machine.
Sea Machine.
No, that doesn't work. Yeah, it doesn't sound as good.
So now you can do the sequel to 300.
Yeah, there's actually a Sea Machine, and I think it made its original appearance in one of the, oh boy, was it a companion module or a master module? But one of the high-level modules, I think maybe it was a master, had basically a huge naval encounter. you're out there with, like, the entire, like, fleet of Norwald or something, and, like, the Northern Ocean, and you get, like, attacked, and there's this massive engagement, and it actually introduces the rules of the Sea Machine.
The heady days of early D&D.
Right.
You could run that along the Savage Coast.
Yeah, it wasn't the Savage Coast, but it was like, oh boy, maybe it was, maybe Vengeance of Alphax, or I can't remember what the exact module was. I'll look it up and I'll say in the next episode, but...
Yeah, and I can post it on our website
right.
as well.
But that was pretty cool,
you know,
too.
You could even import that battle system into other editions, into other games for that matter, really, if you worked it out, if you worked out the math. You know, the first thing I thought of was bringing it over to first edition AD&D and using it as an expansion on the slaver modules, because, you know, the slave lords are pirates. They sail the seas.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be fun to use that. You know, you go out there representing, you know, the commonwealths that have hired you to take them out, and you meet the slavers on the oceans.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, really cool. And I'm assuming it gives you the ability to run smaller battles, too.
Yeah, it does. And actually, I believe it is the module is M1 into the Maelstrom. I just looked it up, and that apparently
okay.
is the module where the Sea Machine actually appears.
Yeah, that's the one that has the picture of the wizard looking over what looks like a whirlpool or something, right?
That's right, yeah. And that's the master modules where you get really high level.
Okay.
So that was neat. And then, of course, that's not to be confused with some of the stuff that you see in the Rule Encyclopedia and the Beckby sets where if you're on the oceans and you're sailing, what happens if you run into a storm? Are you going to get knocked off course? What's going to happen to your ship? You remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Too. And when I used to play, or when I still play, Isle of Dread, you got to get to the Isle of Dread, right? And just
exactly.
That whole thing, I'd turn that into an adventure right there.
I definitely. In fact, the game I'm running In Search of the Unknown right now as a play-by-post, and we've been playing for a while, but with quite a few of the players are pretty much forumites. We had our own forum over on the Wild Games Productions RFI boards. We have our own thread over there. And I'm making them do everything all the way up to getting to the actual module.
Nice.
And so they're having never in any game you run. You, obviously, if time is a factor, you want to start with the adventure. But if you have the luxury of time, never forget that just getting to the adventure is like half the fun.
Oh, yeah. You know, what's funny, too, is that one thing I've already noticed about, especially kind of like newer editions, like adventuring and everything, it's where you set off to find dungeon or the, you know, Hall of the Mountain King or whatever you're supposed to do. Everybody's on foot. And they look at me like I'm crazy when I say, where are our horses? They're like, what do you mean horses? I'm like, we're going to have horses, guys.
We're going to walk the equivalent of three states away?
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. It's like, where's my carriage? I don't know. Where are my horses? I'm like, what are we doing?
Yeah, my players, fortunately, they were wise enough to have steeds.
Yeah.
To get them where they were going. But yeah, that's an important thing, you know. And to take that a point further, you know, if you look at any other game, you know, look at a modern day game, people need to think about transportation. You know, if you're playing modern day, think about how are you taking a cab? Are you taking a car? Right. Where are you leaving it? You're playing futuristic, say Star Frontiers. Well, most people really in that situation, they actually do think of the transportation because that's kind of like the spaceship, right?
But we're going to cover all this in our transportation special edition podcast,
right? Well, Michael knows full well
your car's in you.
Get around in like World of Warcraft. Your character can magically run just for like miles and miles and miles.
Absolutely.
With massive equipment on our rack.
Or swim.
But like I said, we'll cover that in our transportation edition. Look
blood on the
that.
Table.
Can't wait to see that. We're also going to have a special edition on what to wear while adventuring.
And
so yeah,
what not
should
to
cover
wear.
Exactly. So yeah, that should be a real crowd.
Adventurers pack, you know.
Right.
But all right. So what else do we need to know about?
I think
all these
at this
things?
Point, Colin, unless you can think of anything else we haven't covered that kind of covers the Mincer edition.
Yeah, I mean, aside from obviously the minutia, but that pretty much.
Well,
gives you a pretty good introduction.
Right.
And,
we should let our listeners off the hook.
On the whole, I don't think there are huge differences. If you're used to playing Moldvay or even Holmes and you were to move to Mincer's edition, I don't think it's going to be like, whoa, you know, your world's not going to start spinning. But there are differences. So, you know, these are just some of the things that to be aware of, and you know, maybe you'll prefer them, maybe you won't. And as with anything else in role-playing, if you don't like it, treat it like a salad bar. You take what you like, and you leave the rest behind.
That's right. Absolutely.
There you go. All right, guys. With that, I'm going to say keep playing with dead things, and have a good night.
Okay.
All right, guys. It's been a slice, and so... That's our podcast. Thank you for joining us.
I'm already a couple beers in.
Don't
it's
put that
cool.
in.